Hey everyone, and welcome to Purple Row Radio. My name is Greg Stanwood. I'm a staff writer at Purple Row, and I am here along, as always, with the harbinger of Purple
Row. Sorrow.
Well, yes.
Eddie McTallick, there.
The harbinger of the harbinger of baseball writing on the Colorado Rockies, Andrew Martin. Hey Andrew, what's going on?
Metallica, apparently.
Metallica.
Well, you said Harbinger. I thought Harvester of Sorrow, which is kind of a cool song. And,
no, I was just pulling out a word of interest on the fly as I'm going to try to do every podcast now.
Well, I like the new titles. I need to like change my title regularly. Is it as you dub me, whatever? No, for the totally off topic.
Soothsayer.
I don't think anyone's ever soothed by anything I say, Greg. But no, off topic before we start. So it's Sunday night as we're finishing this recording here today, or starting this recording, or wherever we are in the recording process. And last night...
Somewhere in the middle, but you're hearing this first.
Exactly. We went and saw the Arcade Fire show last night up in Broomfield, and oh my goodness gracious. People listening, if you're a music fan, first of all, if you haven't heard it, get Arcade Fire's new The Suburbs album. It won a Grammy for Best Album, and their show was, I tweeted that it was less of a show, a concert, and more of a life experience. This band was phenomenal to watch. They had like 10 or 11 people up on stage. Not a single person played just one instrument during the show. Like, some people were keyboards. They had two drummers to start out with, and their drummer is also their female vocalist, who also played an accordion during one part, and keyboards during another part, and sang, and played, and they're good. Oh man, I can't even describe it. It wasn't just the gimmick of, hey, they're switching instruments. It was phenomenal. If you hear the album, listen to it a couple times, you're gonna love it. And then if you get a chance to see their live show, go see that too, because, oh my goodness, my question was, how on earth are they going to take these sounds on this album and try to recreate them live? And they did it. I don't know how they did it, but they did it. But that's what's going on, Greg. The Arcade Fire.
Want to know an interesting fact, or perhaps not so interesting, that won't surprise you at all?
Go for it.
I've never been to a concert.
Really?
Nope. My interest in music is limited to its use pretty much in terms of cinema, television sort of stuff.
I one of my best friends in high school, he's chasing his dreams in Hollywood and doing film scores and stuff like that, and working with, you know, legit people whose names I couldn't mention because I don't remember. But
I did see John Williams conduct live once. I guess
that's pretty cool.
That counts as a concert, but I've never been to, like, you know, an Arcade Fire type thing. But
if someone who doesn't go see a lot of shows and doesn't listen to a whole lot of music, as far as mainstream music, you know, rock or whatever goes, seeing a big name band play is kind of intimidating because it's crowded and there's, you know, not much room to move or breathe, and it's really, really loud and stuff like that. I can definitely see how not going to a concert would be something, you know, that outlandish.
Yes. Well, we've spent 3 minutes now talking about music, and I'd love to continue on an off-topic podcast, but
we are not making an off-topic podcast.
I am interested in making a film podcast at some point.
Everyone, film podcast, Greg Stanwood, man of many podcasting talents.
Upcoming sometime in the next 2 months to 20 years. We'll see.
Give or take a decade.
Yes. So, we're now, for the first time, we're recording a show with an actual week or so of play behind us. Might have a little bit more to talk about, but as usual, let's start by just recapping the week a little bit, talking about how everybody's doing. The team in general is doing okay. We're off to a pretty good start, and I think the topic that I'm most interested in talking about in terms of players who have been successful recently are the two performances we've gotten out of our injury replacements, Esmel Rogers and Greg Reynolds, who both out of one start each have surpassed expectations quite a bit.
Well, Rogers came in and flat out dominated. He pitched an out into the eighth inning, struck out like seven guys, I think walked one or two, gave up four.
18 straight outs somewhere in that.
Just ridiculous. And I mean, And I've said it before on the podcast, and I'll still stand on what I said, but I did not see this coming from Ismael Rogers. What we saw from Greg Reynolds, and we'll dive into him a bit more, but we saw, you know, an effective but far less dominating performance from him. I expected to see that out of Rogers, but Rogers came up with fire in his belly and ice water in his veins and grit under his fingernails and, I don't know, just other good things to say about him, and just blew all expectations out of the water. I was beyond impressed by what Ismael Rogers came up with. And granted, it's against the Pirates, but before we just malign the Pirates, even though we did take three of four from them during this series, it's not a miserable lineup. They have a lot of good players in that lineup, and we saw Jose Tabata hit his first, or maybe it's Jose.
Yeah.
I'm so used to saying Jose Theodore because I'm an Avalanche fan as well, so whenever I see Jose, I'm always like, no, it's not Jose, it's Jose. But maybe it is Jose. I don't know. I'm not a person of Latin persuasion. I'm about as white as freaking Wonder Bread.
If it is, I don't think anybody told any announcer for any team because I've never heard it pronounced differently than Jose. But,
well, then again, how long did it take them to get Yolis Chacin right?
And they still don't. I was listening to, Jack Corrigan. That's his name. I almost said Jack Etkin, but he's a writer. Jack Corrigan on the radio still says Jolis. And,
which isn't, it isn't too bad.
No, I think there's actually just, they've reached a point where everybody has found a way they like to pronounce it, and all of them are close to correct, and that's good enough.
there's only one that I really take exception with, and that is, have you heard about our ace, Ubaldo Jimenez? It's like nails on a chalkboard.
Uh-huh. I know how to pronounce it properly, but once on a show last year, I said it incorrectly. I was talking quickly or something, and you were not pleased with me.
I mean, have you heard about this Toad Heelton player we have playing first base? I hear he's pretty good. And Troy Tulowitzki, that's a good one too.
Tulowitzki's different. It is annoying to me when people try to spell it incorrectly, but I shouldn't complain about that because I spelled it wrong myself for like 2 months. But
when we first drafted him, even Rocks Girl spelled it with an S. It was embarrassing for everyone involved.
Yeah, for my mistake was putting the wrong letter on the end. I would spell it with a Y. Yeah.
Well, what was funny is they had a thing going on at Coors Field where they it was 2008, I think, and they had just, you know, one of those between-inning gimmicks where they had someone say, it's the Rocky spelling test. Can you spell Tulowitzki's name? And they had this one really obnoxious girl going, T-U-L-O-T-W-W-Tulowitzki! And she'd really just had this inane drone to, not inane, that's the wrong word, but, she was being silly, obviously, but it was, again, another grating sound on the chalkboard of my brain. Uh-huh. And, they had like little clips of Tulowitzki going, no, that's not even close. No, that's awful. Just awful. And then they had someone else try to spell Iannetta, and then she starts spelling Iannetta's name and then spells it wrong, and then spells Tulowitzki's name wrong, and then says Tulowitzki again, and, it's actually spelled kind of phonetically. I mean, you read it, you can pronounce it. It's,
yeah.
I mean, the worst you could be like is Tulowitzki or something like that. Even then, you'd know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like, granted, Jimenez isn't exactly, you know, mysterious as to who you're discussing, but I mean, yeah. Anyways, now that we've ranted about pronunciation names, Jose Tabata took his first two home runs of the year off of the Rockies, and they were at frustrating times. Well, I can't imagine a good time to have a home run hit.
When you're ahead 12 to nothing, maybe?
Even then, it's never good. Never, because that screws your shutout up. Anyways, no, I mean, the Pirates lineup is not a bunch of pushovers. There's a couple spots out there, like Ronnie Cedeno, for example, that you don't really count on to be, you know, a big bat-producing spot in the lineup. But at the same time, I mean, the Rockies looked very good against them. Jorge De La Rosa lost his command during the second game of the season.
And he still has blister issues, too.
Apparently, but he said it wasn't the problem, but, you know, whatever. I've stopped listening to what they say when they say it's not a problem, because these guys have a broken leg and they'd say it's not a problem. No professional baseball player is going to say, ouch, I'm hurt, oh no, please discount all of my bad numbers now.
Yeah, we definitely learned about that when Jeff Francis, who you would think about as being, like, the most honest person ever, just based on his personality, was trying to downplay his injuries in early 08, and the home opener ended up being kind of washed away, as I recall.
Yeah, it was a rain-out game.
But he threw like 14 straight balls to start the game, and afterward, even though the game didn't count, he was saying like, oh yeah, I'm just totally fine. I just didn't have my stuff. And then a few weeks went by, and it turns out that he was apparently in rather serious pain for the entire time. So.
Yeah, well. They're troopers. But, yeah, you said the two starters. Greg Reynolds was expected to be the worst of the bunch, and he actually did just fine. Six innings pitched, he allowed only two runs, walked two, struck out two, or was it three runs? Two runs in the bullpen, gave up the next one. No, it was a good start from Greg Reynolds. I mean, better than anyone expected. We just wanted him to give us a chance to win. Surely enough, he did, and got a no decision on the day, but it was a tie game going into, I believe, the eighth inning when Ty Wigginton hit a bases-clearing double down the left field line, which, interestingly enough, the night before during the million-inning game, well, only 14, that's not exactly a million, we've seen worse, but he hit that same ball that Pedro Alvarez died for, made the catch, and then threw Ty Wigginton as the speed of a catcher out at first base. He made that same play, but Alvarez did not come up with it on Saturday night, and the Rockies took a 6-3 lead.
Wigginton might actually be slower than most catchers. He's a large guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, he made up for it well enough. I'm not complaining about Ty Wigginton after,
We don't need him to be stealing bases or laying out bunts.
We're sending him running.
Aggressive base running.
Oh my gosh, kill me now. No, so as far as, performances went over the weekend, I mean, I think we would be utterly remiss if we just talked about the pitching and did not bring up one scrappy little second baseman of ours by the name of Johnny Herrera.
Who's walked like seven times this series or
That's
something like
that? That's what's mind-blowing. A guy like him, you don't expect to see him walking. And this is what a lot of the pundits are saying about him, especially on the website. I mean, it's not meant to be a lot of people make it out to be kind of a political issue, as if like, you know, well, whose camp are you at, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I'm in the Rockies' win camp. That's the camp that I'm in. I have no personal stake in Johnny Herrera or Jorge Lopez. I mean, heck, we could bring anyone up, and I would have no personal stake in them except for possibly Chris Nelson. And even then, it's not like a personal stake. I just like farmhands getting shots. And the irony is that Herrera is a farmhand, and la 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 la. I guess farmhands of pedigree, I should say, considering his draft slot. Mm-hmm. But Herrera's definitely been impressing. And so for those of you listening who think that I have nothing good to say about Johnny Herrera whatsoever and hate him and want him to fall off a building, that is not true. Johnny Herrera's batting .455 in the season right now. And there's no way he's going to keep up a .455 batting average. There's just not a way. But the fact is that the big complaint is if we want to bolster that his on-base percentage, because we know anybody who knows anything about the Rockies knows that Herrera is not a power hitter. Not even like really a doubles hitter. He's a singles hitter. He's a slap hitting singles hitter. And I am okay with that, provided he can keep it up. The concern was there's no way he's going to be able to keep up that on base percentage that he had, which is like 350, 360, something like that. Totally doable for the two hole. Because there's all slap singles. And eventually slap singles go away. Those wells do dry up. And anybody denying that is fooling themselves, I'm afraid to say. But he's supplementing it with walks now. So if you're walking, your slap single spring, it could dry up a bit. And you're still going to be able to get on base because you're taking the free pass. Granted, Herrera is taking walks at a Barry Bonds pace right now. And that's accounting for intentional walks that Bonds got in his monster walk here. But, I mean, this is a good sign. If he's able to slow down his plate appearance a little bit and still be a good contact hitter while, taking the walks, I really am not going to complain about having a good glove man in the two hole who is also getting on base very well. I'm really not. Jorge Lopez has come through in a lot of big situations so far, but Herrera has been setting the table for them. This is kind of going back to the battle of the offseason. What do you want more? Do you want the power hitter in the seven, or do you want the table setter in the two? Well, my answer is just whoever can do their job better. Right now it looks like Herrera is, but that isn't saying that Lopez should get no playing time. The fact that he can play third base and Helton being questionable at the exact moment means you can have a first base Wigginton, second base Herrera, shortstop Tulo, and third base Lopez, and you have a entirely righty infield right there. Well, Herrera's switch, but the point stands. No, I mean, good for Herrera. I hope he keeps this up because like I said, I don't care who's doing the job as long as somebody's doing the job well.
Yeah, I was about to say basically what you said, that we kind of can play both right now because Ian Stewart is not getting full playing time right now, and we've seen Herrera at second, Lopez at third the past couple games, and with the way it's been producing, not it necessarily as being the two of them together, as they're both separate parts of the lineup, but the way the two of them have been producing, I think that there is quite a bit of room for them to get a couple starts together over the next few days as we go through New York. It is funny because the debate over which of them should be starting at second really did produce a lot of people, you know, picking sides. But now, when you read all these comments, everybody is very pleased with what they've seen of Lopez so far, and also pleased with Herrera, and it's kind of like everybody wins, and now there's a we can all just get along for a little while vibe going on.
Yeah, I mean, Lopez is starting to show his true colors a little bit. I mean, he has all of 29 at-bats on the season, but he's batting .241. A lot of those hits have come through in pretty big situations.
Yes.
But until, I mean, and normally I'm the first person to eschew that, okay, big hits, whatever. I don't really think that's something, it's something that's going to give you more playing time in the eyes of a manager. But at the same time, we don't have that much better of a third base option right now.
Mm-hmm.
As much as we've been pleased with a lot of the things that Wigginton's done, he's batting .231 on the season with a .567 OPS. That's bad. That's really bad. Again, 26 at-bats into the season, I'm not going to set the man on fire right now. Let's see what he does, you know. It's almost like we need to, like, just shut everything down and revisit this in May, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But for questionable, I mean, given how the only solidified spots in the infield right now are catcher and shortstop, we're going to have to keep talking about this until, you know, something forces the issue. And right now, nobody's forcing the issue. I mean, as long as guys are going to be coming up in big spots and being adequate enough in the positions they're playing, really, just do your thing. I don't care right now. The Rockies are winning games. Blah. I mean, I know it sounds kind of silly just to kind of brush it all under the rug, but that's really all I care about right now is, you know, how well guys are doing the jobs that are ahead of them. And they're doing a good enough job. Clearly, the team's winning right now. We're 5-2. I will cry about other
things. 6-2 now.
6-2, thank you. Bless it. See, this is why I never try to keep track of the record. I just always look it up somewhere. I never know what the Rockies' record is at any given moment, because I'm more just like, we got to win tomorrow. We didn't win yesterday. We got to win tomorrow, or whatever. Yeah, so that's a lot of me talking myself in circles. That was pretty exciting.
Going back real quick to what we were talking about before with Reynolds and Rogers, the two of them are in an important year for the future of their careers. And, I mean, they're both given this extra season where they can be sent to the minors. And as we look forward into 2012, Aaron Cook's probably going to be gone definitively. We're going to have Jimenez will obviously still be here. We're going to have Chacin, Hamill. And then De La Rosa's contract doesn't become, you know, optional until 2 years from now. So four of those slots are already kind of assumed to be set. And you have guys like Rogers and Reynolds who are going to be out of options. And basically this season and next spring training are their audition times. And both of them happen to get starts right here off the bat at the major league level and, you know, make at least a little bit of a statement. And I mean, the statement doesn't have to be my one start should earn me a job a year from now. Obviously, it's more that, don't forget about us. We, could be candidates for your 2012 fifth starter spot. So
it's weird to think about that far in the future. I mean, it's, I mean, obviously, you're not really trying to nail down a rotation a year
away from now.
But
for all we know, one of our pitchers will be injured for the whole season, or we're going to make a trade or something like that. I mean, it's certainly not a predictive thing, but more as these guys have to be aware that this is their year to prove it. And
yeah. I mean, for the sake of very brief discussion, the only three pitchers that are guaranteed to be in the rotation next year, and this is barring injury, of course, would be Jimenez, De La Rosa, and Chacin. Because Jimenez is under contract till 2014. De La Rosa's under contract until, I believe, 2014 as well. Is that
kind
right?
Of. His contract is unusual. He's under contract through 2012. That's the only team control.
And
after
the two
that,
option years.
Well, right. And the two option years are odd because he has one and then we have one.
So basically it's De La Rosa's choice if he wants it to be a 2-year contract or a 4-year contract.
Exactly. And then it's our choice if we want it to be a 3-year contract or a 4-year contract after that.
So for those of you who missed it, he has a player option on year 3 of the contract where he decides whether he wants to take the option year or go to free agency. And then the fourth year of the contract, if he accepts that player option, the team has an option on the fourth year. So if the team says, hey, we still think you're the guy, he gets the fourth year. If they say, you're done, they buy him out and he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming those three take, I mean, they'll all be here next year. Cause there's no way we lose Chacin after 1 year. There's no way we lose Ubaldo. And with De La Rosa under contract, I mean, we're not losing him either.
Well, and
Hamill's a question mark in my mind, but this is, again, way, 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 way looking forward.
He is, but I take the fact that they signed him to 2 years, as opposed to just one through arbitration, that, they intend for him to be the fourth starter next year.
And I agree with that principle.
And I also agree with you. That it won't necessarily be that way, but they are looking at him slotted in there right now.
I guess I'm looking at them kind of differently. Chacin's going to be in his slave years still, his real cheap league minimum years. Ubaldo's under the team-friendly contract, and you don't trade Ubaldo's not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And De La Rosa, I mean, considering he was technically a free agent target, but they made it a major league point of signing him. I just see those three contract situations as being different than Hamill, because Hamill's was more of a, we're just buying out your arbitration years, so we don't have to tangle with this for the rest of your arbitration years. And then number five is, like you said, it could be Christian Friedrich.
It could, and it could be some free agent signing, or
it could be Esmiel Rogers, or it could be Greg Reynolds,
or it could be Sean Main. Imagine that.
It could be, who knows? Who knows? Although Main's looked awful so far, but
our whole AAA pitching staff has looked pretty awful. Clay Mortensen is somebody whose name is going to be in that discussion, though he's going to get the bonus option that Rogers and Reynolds got this year, next year, so he's still a little bit farther out than that. But he had a rough outing. I didn't see what Billy Buckner did today, but I don't really think that matters too much.
Not much. But anyways, I feel like there's something I'm missing right now. Stewart, I mean, we talked about third base options, having Lopez at third base. Defensively speaking, and I know for a lot of people who follow the Mariners, that saying Jose Lopez is a positive defensive option anywhere has never really been a sentence that makes sense. I might as well say the sky is purple, you know? Or whatever. I guess this guy could be purple.
Helton is young.
Exactly. Todd Helton's young. Dexter Fowler can literally fly. You know what I mean? So things like that. Actually, it's funny. I'm picturing the Simpsons episode, Homer at Bat, where this company softball team brings in a bunch of major league ringers, and they all have to compete.
We talked about this episode last week, too.
Perfect. I'm bringing it up again. It's just the part where Homer Simpson's in right field, and Daryl Strawberry's also in right field. Homer goes, I got it on a fly ball. And then Daryl Strawberry just simply steps in front of him and then jumps 30 feet in the air, catches the fly ball, and then lands. Yeah, that's what I figure. That's what I'm picturing Fowler doing right there. Although I guess I believe it a bit more with Fowler. Anyways, with having Jose Lopez at third base, a lot of the beat staff and actually UZR actually liked him at third base last year for Seattle. But he looks to be a positive contributor defensively at the third base position. I mean, never mind the good plays we've seen him make at second base. Just speaking about third base here, he has good step to his left. Or was his right? Whatever it is. He ranges well at third base. He has a strong throwing arm. He appears to be a good option at third base. So with Ian Stewart being 0 for the season still, and no, I'm not exaggerating. He is, in fact, 0
for the season.
He is,
yeah. And he's only gotten like 2 starts or so. But
well, even,
it's kind of like 15 at-bats or so, right?
Yeah, the fact that he has 15 at-bats kind of says something. It's not that they haven't given him shots. He's played in 6 games with 11 at-bats. And he struck out more than half of them. And,
yeah, and I mean, we knew that, breaking with the team in general was a little bit contested up until the last minute. And, they ended up deciding to go with him over Willie Taveras, which still makes sense to an extent, especially since Taveras is not on the actual roster. No. And we would have had to you know, do more than we would have wanted to make room for him. But at the same time, we should keep in mind that there's nothing keeping Stewart on the team right now. He has free option years.
If he has two of them, if Rocky's roster is accurate, yes, which I assume it is,
it
Greg.
Is. He was purchased in 08 and optioned down in 08. And since then, he's been on the roster the entire year for both 9 and 10. So I don't have every player's contract status memorized, but Stewart's is pretty easy to remember.
Yeah, well, Ian Stewart is at this point, right? I mean, a lot of people would say, well, this is his make or break, and he's not stepping up with the plate. He hasn't had a full spring training.
Right.
I mean, he missed half of that.
He is easily a full week and a half to 2 weeks behind everybody else.
And the fact that he's not getting the regular playing time he would be getting if he had that 2 weeks in spring training. I mean, it's not like you're going to suddenly get yourself back into perfect form by pinch hitting. He looks lost. He just does not look good at the plate in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing he has done has been a positive contribution to the bats of the team. And I'm not trying to indict the guy. I mean, anybody here knows that I like Ian Stewart, and I'm always defending him because he's relatively youngish, and I just see zillion home run potential out of him and other good things. But right now, this is almost like Chris Iannetta last year. Slightly different situation, obviously, but Iannetta was optioned because, Miguel Olivo tore the cover off the ball for the first 2 months of the season, and they just sent him down to the Springs. He tore the crap off out of the ball, and that was the end of the story. He came back up and actually outperformed Olivo from the moment he came up to the end of the season, if you look at those arbitrary endpoints there. With Stewart, though, I mean, he's just – the reason they sent Iannetta down for face value anyways was saying that Iannetta just does not have enough playing time, and we're not going to get him enough playing time because we're not going to take Miguel Olivo out of the lineup if we don't have to. So the same thing with Stewart. Not that Lopez or Wigginton are really tearing the cover off the ball, but we're talking about throwing Stewart in the lineup at the potential expense of another 0 for day right there. I mean, at least Wigginton and Lopez have been able to contribute like single hits. I don't see Stewart doing that right now. And again, I've said it like 3 times, but not an indictment of him. It's just saying he's not ready yet, and he needs to be optioned and just sent back to extended spring training just to work on a swing, just to get his timing back.
Yeah, give it two weeks or so. And I mean, I think it's clear that we have quite a bit of depth there with Lopez, Herrera, and Wigginton all able to play third. And I assume we would bring up somebody like Nelson in that time who can also play third.
Which would make sense. I mean, let's think about the infield. We have Helton, Giambi, Tulowitzki, Lopez, Herrera,
and Wigginton.
Wigginton, that's 6 infielders right there. And mm-hmm. In the outfield, we have Cargo, Dex, Smith, Spielborgs, and that's all.
Yeah.
And then I guess Wigginton, technically, but I really would rather not see him in left field again unless we absolutely have to. But, no, I mean, yeah, that makes sense. If you're going to send Stewart down, just bring up another utility-esque guy. And if we're insisting on putting Wigginton in the outfield, then you might as well make it a strictly infielder like Nelson, just for the sake of pinch-hitting depth and potential home plate stealing.
Yeah, we certainly need more of that.
That's a skill set right there. You can prove that.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out what, like, magic trick or illusion he used to distract that pitcher.
Well, if you recall, it was actually supposed to be a hit and run.
Yes, yes.
And Miguel Olivo was like, "I'm Miguel Olivo," and Nelson took off for the hit and run. And the pitcher was like, "Do, there's no one on third. Oh my gosh, he's almost home." And
yeah, he as I recall, the Nelson basically broke early, and you know, obviously wasn't going to stop in the middle, but when people started making noise like, runner's going, his first thought was, the runner on first is running. So he turned around and his back to Nelson and was like, wait a minute, nobody's moving. Oh, God.
Yes, Jason, this is the kind of subterfuge that Chris Nelson brings to the team. He uses skills of deception and psychic abilities to convince pitchers to look at wrong bases.
There you go.
I'm going to stand on this. Ian Stewart needs to be optioned, and it's, again, not, I hate you, Ian Stewart, get your game together or get cut or traded. It's, hey, man, your knee was hurt all of spring training. Go down and finish spring training first, and then if you're looking good in spring training, we'll call you back up. If not, we'll just stick you with the Sky Sox for a little while until you're feeling a bit better about everything and then bring you back up.
Yeah, it's certainly not a any form of punishment, more of a rehabilitation without
precisely
without an actual disabled list thing. And I mean, I suppose they could probably put him on the disabled list, but as I was talking with you before we started recording, you know, Stewart is several years now into his major league career. He's headed towards his third. He's still below three, but he'll be over three by the end of the season. He doesn't really need those option years. He's not, just getting started, right? He's already a fixture, and, there's no reason to be too conservative with those. He doesn't need to, basically we don't need to keep him up here and wait for a better opportunity to put him back down later. Now is a good a time as any. I mean, the fact that he has those two, this is what we need to use him for, right? This is exactly the sort of thing where players who are often out of options by this point, ones who have been more up and down, but Stewart has pretty much been a fixture ever since his call-up. The fact that we have those in our pocket is perfect. This is the perfect opportunity to go ahead and use those. So
yeah, I mean, being I'm the kind of guy when I play a video game, I always have just zillions of pounds of ammunition in my inventory or never use the special things that I get during the game, the power-ups or whatever, because I'm always like, what if I need it later? What if I need it later? You need those option years when a guy is, A, not going to get consistent playing time, B, just doesn't look developmentally ready, or C, there's just no spot for him on the major league roster, and he's Rule 5 eligible. So with Stewart, this is one of those situations where he has no time for playing time because the guys who are in his way are playing well enough, and he needs the rehab. So, I mean, you can't, unless someone wants to stab him, like I suggested before recording.
No.
Just a little stab, you know, nothing big. Just, you know, cut him a little bit so it draws blood, and they'll be like, oh, look at that, cut, DL.
Somebody is going to hear this. One of our 11 listeners is going to hear this and complain, for sure.
Okay, we're not going to actually stab Ian Stewart.
I saw a couple weeks ago, I don't think we mentioned this on the show, but I might as well bring this up now because it made me laugh. If you recall, back when we were just starting this show last year and we were going over the new non-roster invitees and neither of us was as familiar with the minor leagues as we are now and there were a bunch of names we didn't know, we got like three emails saying, these guys, you know, you shouldn't say you've never heard of them because they're far richer and more talented than you'll ever be. And,
yeah, let's see that guy make an ASPX page for his company's website.
Well, and I just happened to see that you got the same feedback for one of your spring training game wraps when you said like, the Rockies played a great game. And then when we stuck around for extra batting practice in the ninth and threw out the
pizza delivery boy,
exactly.
And
yeah.
Best Buy employee or whatever I called him. And I called Chris Malone Carl Malone because I grew up a Utah Jazz fan, so the name Carl Malone is kind of John Elway-esque to me. So, it's a joke. It's funny. I understand that minor leaguers have hearts and souls too, but I'm pretty sure that they would think things are funny too. I'm pretty sure there's a minor league player out there who has a self-deprecating sense of humor, and they would probably make the same joke themselves. Like, man, I should just be delivering pizza after a really bad game or something like that.
A lot of those guys are on Twitter, and they actually say those things.
Exactly. I'm pretty sure everyone has a sense of humor, and I'm hoping that our listeners do as well. We love that you listen to us, and we love that you don't, you know, call the cops on me for threatening to stab Ian Stewart and things like that.
You better watch out. Somebody out there. There's a lot of crazy people out there.
I bet Ian Stewart listens to this and is like, man, that guy's going to stab me. I don't want to get stabbed.
If there's any player on the team who listens to this, it probably is Ian Stewart.
Yeah, seriously. I bet Craig Baker listens to us too.
Okay, if Craig Baker listens to us, then he should say so. Of course, unfortunately, he's not in our organization anymore.
Yeah, that is kind of depressing. He's a very active Twitter user, and he was fun for feedback. Andrew Fisher had a lot of commentary back and forth with him, and I don't know. It's sad to see fun personalities leave the organization.
Yeah, I always feel a little bit bad, even when it's players that I don't really know about. At this point, I know most of them by name, but players that I've never really been all that interested in from a performance standpoint or a prospect standpoint. I still always feel bad when there's like a new wave of minor league releases, you know, I just.
Yeah, I mean, just when I talked to Mark Gustafson in 2009, the way they talked about some of the trades that were made, because they traded Connor Graham, who was, I believe, was he in Modesto or Tulsa, do you recall?
Back then, I didn't know the difference between Tulsa and Modesto. I didn't even know who Connor Graham was. I thought he and Andy Graham were the same guy.
let's see. Connor Graham, let's take a look at his numbers real quick just because it'll tell me the last year. Before we traded him, he was in Modesto, and then after the trade, he was promoted to Double A with Cleveland. Connor Graham was traded for Rafael Betancourt, and when I talked to, and Betancourt's obviously been a phenomenal acquisition, and while I do wish Connor Graham the absolute best, I am much happier having Rafael Betancourt on the team than I am having Connor Graham in Tulsa. You know, God bless the man, and again, best of luck in your career going forward, even though this is 2 years old. No, the point that I was making is that Gustafson, when he spoke about the way that they deal with these trades, and I can't remember if I mentioned Hynek as well, or maybe it was Hynek we were talking about, but apparently Dan O'Dowd, the Rockies GM, actually will make these phone calls. He'll say, "Hey, look, man, I got some news for you. We've decided to make a move, and we are trading you, in Hynek's case, to the Chicago White Sox in exchange for Jose Contreras and Connor Graham to the Indians for Rafael Betancourt." But it's not just like they get them, there's like a sticky note on their locker saying, "Come talk to your manager, you're cut, goodbye, game over," or whatever. Like, the organization takes these things very seriously, and I'm very proud to be a fan of a team that really treats their, and the guys who are, to put it, use it crassly, minor league filler, but the guys who are really, they're good guys, they're good teammates, but they're really not major league caliber players, that they still treat them like people, like players, like saying, "Hey, this is, you know, you've been a big deal in our organization, and, you know, we're sorry we never saw you in the majors or whatever, but, you know, best of luck in your new situation."
Mm-hmm.
When they say our organization is, you know, we're building from within and we want to have the right guys everywhere, they're not kidding.
Mm-hmm. Did you read the Inside the Rockies profile of Mike McHenry as he was traded? There was an article that I think Jack Etkin wrote where it detailed McHenry's experience leaving the team basically when he was told he was traded. It was a real interesting read for learning about the process behind the scenes of how that works.
I'll be honest, I missed it. So, I mean, I was more focused on getting the news up and stuff. I would love, I mean, what can you, can you give me a bit of a rundown on it?
Cause I'm looking for it right now. I'll see if I can actually dig it up, but I don't remember. Let's see, here it is. Yeah. And this was actually written a couple days later when he had already joined the Red Sox organization. It was basically, saying that, he was, he had already been optioned to minor league camp, and he showed up, and he was in the lineup, and then an hour later he learned he was scratched, and, so forth. And, apparently he found out from his wife first that he had been traded. She somehow found out before he did. And, I'll link you to that, I guess, if you're interested.
Make sure to put this link in. For those of you listening, make sure to check the post for the article or for this podcast as well, because we'll put the link in there as well.
All right. Yeah.
But I think the points kind of stand. This isn't a heartless machine of an organization. We care about our players. Everyone's important, and I'm still going to make fun of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
That's just the way it is with you.
That's the way it is. If you can't laugh at everything in the sport, then you're not having enough fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm not saying that you should roll around in the outfield like Manny Ramirez. Speaking of Manny Ramirez, oh my gosh, I'll make this quick, but.
Yes. We are running long here.
Yeah, I'm enjoying myself for once. I mean, I always enjoy myself.
Manny Ramirez.
Seriously, yes. Ramirez, I mean, the guy is Hall of Fame caliber. Honestly, he is one of the best right-handed bats of all time. Yes, I don't care if he played in the stereo era. I don't care if he had the Green Monster to bounce doubles off of. The guy was a phenomenal right-handed bat. phenomenal. However, he had the apparently had the not foresight, but the why does my vocabulary always fail me in the middle of these things right there? He has the I guess mental acuity of, you know, someone who's not a Hall of Famer. Boy, that was real eloquent right there. No, the second violation of the drug policy, second time busted, and well, nothing was specifically released that I saw, at least. I mean, maybe there's more details, but I didn't really see. I saw Manny Ramirez retires. Eh, well, that's the end of recovering that. I really don't want to know much more about it.
No.
But it's like, do you want to face a 100-game suspension or just quit? And he just quit. I mean, it makes me, it reminds me of, bring another hockey reference up, when Marty McSorley took his hockey stick and basically swung it like a battle axe at Donald Brashear and took Donald Brashear out of the game and, like, could have killed him with that hit. They basically said, yeah, you're suspended for a good long time. And he goes, screw this, I quit, and just retired. Because, I mean, he was in his late 30s or something like that anyways, and he was, that's his game, he's a thug, and... Yeah, so McSorley just retired, and I figure, Manny Ramirez didn't do anything nearly as heinous as, you know, trying to injure another player in a very assaulting sense. He, you know, he still screwed up, and, you know, his, you know, being in his late 30s and after the debacle the last few years of his career has been, as far as getting traded and, you know, PED suspension and stuff, I mean, probably a good call that he just retires.
And I mean, not to insult him or the Tampa Bay Rays, they're probably not going to be any worse off without him than they are with him right now.
It seemed like everyone in Tampa hated him. I mean, let me rephrase that: the fans in Tampa hated him because he came up to resounding boos. And I mean, yes, there's a little bit of big picture to think about here too. He is a good right-handed bat still. I mean, it would be a mix of DH and left field and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, no one liked, after his years with Boston, I can't imagine anyone in Tampa liked him. And, you know, it's probably just better for everyone all around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with a guy like Manny Ramirez, and I'll try to make this the last point I make here, when you have a Hall of Fame style career as far as being one of the, like I said, one of the best bats right-handed of all time. I mean, the stupid stuff that he did, though, it made some people laugh and say, oh, that Manny, it's Manny being Manny, blah, blah, blah. And some people say, this guy's a clown and has absolutely no respect for the game. And I'm kind of in the middle of it, because some of the stuff he did was funny, but some of the stuff, it's like, all right, dude, we get it. You're wacky or whatever. There's ways to be wacky without being a joke on the field, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's clubhouse pranksters all over the place, and that's one of my favorite things to read about is clubhouse pranks. But when it comes to on-field stuff, like going into the Green Monster to take a phone call and just crap like that, I'm like, really? Who are you? I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I keep saying I mean because I'm so conflicted in as to whether I care or not, really. But, you know, you want to. Part of me wants to salute the Hall of Fame bat, and part of me wants to say good riddance to everything else.
Right. Okay, well, we should move on now. We've got a 20-minute interview with Eric Simon of Amazing Avenue. Amazin, with an apostrophe. I should not say it correctly in that sense. Which we're going to put on right now, and then we'll be back for just a couple minutes to wrap up the show.
And everybody listen closely. This is my boss, so I want to make sure that you're paying good attention, all right? There will be a test.
Okay, I will make sure to write up a test while I'm editing the show.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. We'll see you later. Okay, everyone. We're on with Eric Simon of AmazingAvenue.com, the SB Nation Mets blog. Eric, thanks for joining us tonight.
How nice of you to have me.
It's our pleasure entirely.
So, we have an upcoming series with the Mets, starting Monday the 11th through Thursday the 14th. So we're just continuing our little tradition of, chatting with some of the other SB Nation bloggers. And, we'd like to discuss with you just some of the thoughts on this upcoming series and on your team in general.
Now, the Rockies, every time we come to New York, honestly, I think the Rockies offense as a whole has a tombstone somewhere in Citi Field, and there's probably one in Shea Stadium as well. For some reason, the Rockies cannot win in In New York, despite the fact we had a rainout a couple years back, so I decided to sim the game in OOTP, and we made our own fake game thread for it. And Santana went absolutely wild and was pulled after like three innings, and the Rockies somehow pulled it out, and it was magnificent. And then they proceeded to lose the real makeup game.
Oh no.
So we're not too excited about coming to New York, but we're hoping that this year will be the turnaround, and I absolutely have no idea why I would think that. It's called insanity to put the same team in the same city and expect different results. Let's go ahead and just start out with just general questions here. Health has been the issue for the Mets the past few years, and I know you're probably tired of talking about this by now, especially given that the most expensive player on the team is hurt. What do you think will, health will be, an improvement on this year? Do we see any warning signs already for the Mets? Or do you think that outside of the aforementioned Johan Santana, the team looks like it's, held together well enough with gauze and scotch tape to be able to pull off a decent season in the East this year?
I think it's probably a mixed bag. You're right that Santana is out. He's, you know, the best case scenario is having him coming back somewhere around the All-Star break. You know, there are reports that he'll be out even longer than that. And Jason Bay is on the disabled list as we speak, although it was a mild ribcage type injury, so we expect to have him back sometime this week. You know, it's always hard to tell. The Mets have a, you know, sort of a mixed roster in terms of age. You've got Carlos Beltran, who missed a lot of last year, although, you know, he's looked really good so far this year, and you know, he's playing a new position in right. Obviously, he's been playing center for the rest of his career. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that works for him. Jose Reyes is, he looks healthy. He looks 100%. He missed some time last year as well as the year before. You know, and it was sort of interesting because earlier in his career, he had a lot of problems staying healthy. And then he had 3 or 4 years there where he was healthy and he ended up being one of the best players in the league. And then the last couple of years, he struggled a bit. It's hard to say. I don't expect great health. Obviously, that's the caveat you throw out with just about any team. You know, they might be great if they stay healthy. And, the Mets rotation has some potential health risks because they signed guys like Chris Young and Chris Capuano this past offseason. And you know, they both look pretty good so far, actually. But, you know, they've missed a bunch of time, respectively, in the last couple of years. So it's, you know, those are a couple of your high upside signings. Now, you know, I imagine we'll talk a little bit more about them in a few minutes. But I think overall they look healthy. The guys who are out there look good. David Wright looks good. You know, you got a bunch of young guys like Ike Davis and Josh Tolley and Angel Pagan is in center and he's been healthy for a year or so. So it's, I expect good things, but, you know, if I found out tomorrow that half of the team went down with a variety of injuries, it wouldn't totally surprise me either.
Yeah, we definitely have our share of injury troubles in Colorado with Helton being out again with back troubles, despite the fact that he says he feels springy and young and things like that. You just love to read the beat notes on that and say, it's a good thing Jason Giambi started again today. I mean, he had a good game, but, at the same time, it's like, well, we're playing Jason Giambi at first base, and he's kind of a pinch hitter. Anyways, you mentioned Ike Davis. Great transition there. Everybody swore that he was a salvation of the New York Mets baseball last season. He tapered off a bit, but overall definitely had a positive season. We saw a kind of impressive batting line from him in 2010, especially for, just someone a lot of people west of New York hadn't really heard of him much before. 264, 351, 440 line, 345 weighted on base average for those stat guys out there, and a 115 WRC plus, which again for the non-stat people suggests that he was about 15% above the average batting line, and a good fielder at first base. Do you expect a repeat, an improvement? What's next for Ike Davis?
Yeah, you know, I think it'll be something like a repeat. He had kind of an interesting year last year. He wasn't really on a lot of guys' radars, and then he had an outstanding first couple of weeks in the minor leagues last year, and then he got called up after the Mets dumped a couple of the retreads they had signed last year, like Mike Jacobs. And he came up and he was terrific for, a month or so, and then he struggled, he struggled mightily for maybe 3 months in the middle there. He wasn't hitting for power. He wasn't drawing walks. He really wasn't doing much of anything. Although, to his credit, his defense was pretty solid throughout. But then he kind of came back around the last month of the season. He started drawing walks again. He started hitting for power. And, you like to be optimistic that he's going to carry that over, into the new season. And he certainly hit well so far. He's knocked in 10 runs in the first 9 games, and he's hitting for a little bit of power. And so, I don't expect him to be a superstar, but given what they pay him and given his age, I expect to see a repeat of last year, maybe a little bit more consistency than he had last year. But I think he has upside because he does have a pretty good command of the strike zone. And, he's got a lot of power. He's a really strong guy. And, again, the glove at first is always a plus. So, I think he'll be about what he had last year, maybe, 850, 860 type OPS. I wouldn't be surprised to see it higher, but my expectations are somewhere around what he did last year.
Well, looking at Fangraphs here, we're looking at his isolated power. For those of you who don't know, it's your slugging percentage minus your batting average, designed to kind of be your extra base batting average, if that makes sense. You put up pretty much the same line as far as isolated power home and the road, a 175 at home, 176 on the road. It's not quite pushing past the realms of a solid power hitter, but definitely a positive, especially considering that Shea Stadium was such a relatively strong pitcher's park. City Field, though, we're a year in here? What's the book on pitcher's park, hitter park? What? I know we need a couple years to really evaluate these things strongly, but from someone who watches the Mets play in this park, is it death to power hitters?
So this is actually the third season, believe it or not, but it's,
3 seasons? Good lord. Where am I?
Well, it's been 2.
I'm mixing up with Yankee Stadium. That's my mistake.
No. It opened the same year, so this is the third season for both of them.
I'm bad at everything.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, it's an extreme pitcher's park. There are some interesting angles. It's really tough to dead center and to the power alleys. There's a little bit of room in right field. There's sort of a short area in right field where a lefty could maybe steal a few home runs there. In fact, in the first year, Chase Utley hit a few home runs into this little wedge of space in the outfield. And so it was, disaffectionately known as Utley's Corner by Mets fans. But, it's a tough place for power hitters for sure. The first year there, David Wright somewhat famously hit like 9 home runs or something like that all year. And, he bounced back and had a pretty decent year last year. But, overall, it really does a number on home runs. Although, it's pretty good. As a result, a lot of these parks that are tough on home runs end up being, pretty decent for doubles and triples and things like that. So it doesn't suppress runs the way, maybe a park like Petco does, but it's certainly tough on power hitters. But, Ike Davis hits prodigious shots. He doesn't get ripped off when he hits the ball hard. And, it'll be tough for him, I think, as it will be for everybody. So overall, it's certainly a tough place to hit home runs, no question.
So you had mentioned earlier the names Chris Young and Chris Capuano as two new pitchers that you'd brought in who had been dealing with some on and off injuries and had missed some playing time over the past couple of years. Another name that will mean something to Rockies fans who has a similar history is Taylor Buchholz, who you guys now have in your bullpen, was out 2009 with after surgery, and then spent a lot of the year last year also on rehab assignment. We I'm sure are curious what your thoughts are on Buchholz so far.
He's looked really good so far. The Mets bullpen overall has been it's been kind of a rough going. They sent one guy down. They sent Blaine Boyer down. Actually, they designated him for assignment today, and Jason Isringhausen is coming up to the club tomorrow. But Buchholz has looked good. He walked 3 guys today in 2/3 of an inning, which obviously is not fantastic. But he ended up not allowing any runs, and overall he's looked good. Before today he had really been walking guys and he had been striking guys out. So, he's sort of their, I wouldn't be surprised to see him move into kind of their right-handed setup role. you know, but they're not paying him a whole lot of money. And you know, like you said, he is coming off of arm problems as a lot of the Mets pickups were. So, you know, he's looked good so far, and I'm certainly optimistic. I don't expect him to be fantastic, but I've certainly liked what he's done to this point.
So let's move on to R.A. Dickey here. Everybody loves to hear about knuckleballers. And R.A. Dickey's everyone's favorite junk baller right now, with a 2.45 ERA through two starts. He posted a 2.84 ERA last year, a slight aberration from his FIP, with a 3.65 FIP, but it didn't look to be that outlandish. I mean, a 3.65 FIP from a pitcher in the middle of your rotation, I'll take that every day of the week and twice on Sunday. Hey, it's been a while since we heard that one.
It has been, yeah.
But Dickey so far this season, like I said, 2.45 ERA, a 1-1 record, 11 innings and two starts. Doesn't look bad. He's definitely looking wild, though, which is granted, we're two starts in, but nearly seven walks per nine innings. Let's see, what is the raw number there on walks? And eight walks so far in his 11 innings. Is this a sign of the wheels coming off, or is this just a small sample, you know, bliggity blue?
He's a fascinating pitcher. Everybody loves R.A. Dickey, as you said. He's a really good guy, and he's a really fun interview. He's actually interesting and, compelling. And, what's sort of fascinating about him, beside the fact that he's a knuckleballer and there are so few of them, is at least last year he was among the league leaders in walks per nine innings, on the low side, that is. He was the good leader, not the bad type of leader. Oliver Perez was on the other end of that.
2.17 walks per nine.
I think he might have been second in the NL to Roy Halladay. And, and that startled me as much as anything, is that, I think knuckleballers are sort of notorious for, I don't want to say not knowing where the ball is going, but having a tough time controlling it. And, it was kind of remarkable how much control he seemed to have over it last year. And this year, it's been a couple of starts. His first start was great, and his second start not so much, although he split a fingernail in his last start, and so that it raises some questions about whether he's going to be ready. He said it was bothering him that game, but that it wouldn't affect his next start. Obviously, he's starting against the Rockies in this series, but the fact that he hurt his fingernail, I would chalk up some of the control problems to that. He said he didn't have a great knuckleball that day, and it was kind of a cold day, and he had a tough time getting a feel for it. So, I'm optimistic that he will be perhaps not as good as he was last year, but, a solid middle-of-the-rotation guy. And even though he doesn't have the past history that you would like out of a guy who comes out of the blue and has a great season like he had last year, with knuckleballers, you sort of have to throw that out a little bit, because it's not so crazy for a knuckleballer to figure things out later in his career, because it's not like he's relying on an overpowering fastball or a great changeup or something like that. A knuckleball is the kind of pitch that you develop over time, and in fact, a lot of the great knuckleballers didn't figure it out until later in his career. So, I think there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic about R.A. Dickey going forward.
Oh, yeah, Tim Wakefield's a perfect example of that. He is, 80 now and still pitching in the Red Sox for the Red Sox. Now, realistically speaking, he's 44, and he is still out there throwing that dancing knuckleball. He's coming out of the Red Sox rotation, or bullpen, I should say, right now. But, there's some precedent there to say that older knuckleballers are going to do just fine. I mean, like you said, nothing overpowering. They're not really worried about throwing out their shoulder. I mean,
hell, well, Charlie Huff and the Negroes and Charlie Huff were certainly, they pitched well into their 40s, if not longer than that. So it's fun, because he's sort of a fascinating pitcher to watch, just because there really are so few of them. There's sort of like one great knuckleballer every 10 years or something like that. So it's nice to have him on the Mets.
And we'll be seeing him on the third game of the series, which is Wednesday. Looking over the Mets roster right now, one other thing I noticed was Scott Hairston. I only bring him up because his name has sort of grown to be synonymous with pain and suffering for Rockies fans. He spent, so many years with San Diego and Arizona, and being just around, being a bother for us. And I can tell from some of the other NL West fan bases that he caused some nightmares for other people as well. I don't necessarily know if he's going to be causing any serious problems for us during this particular series. But again, I'm not really too familiar with what his role is on the team right now. Is he starting or is he off the bench?
He's coming off the bench. I mean, he was the fourth outfielder, let's say, when we counted on Jason Bay being in the lineup. Jason Bay is
right.
Hurt. And, you know, and we sort of expected Harrison to play a little bit more, although after the first couple of games, we had Willie Harris actually had a couple of nice starts early on against the Marlins. So he's been getting the bulk of the playing time. Kid Lucas Duda was playing a little bit, but he got sent down to the minors today after the game. So I would expect to see Harrison start at least one of the four games in left field, assuming Jason Bay doesn't come back before them. But yeah, I mean, his role in general will be as sort of a utility guy, backup corner outfielder. He can play a little bit of center field actually. So, you know, he might occasionally get a start there. He had a sort of an amazing spring. His first game, he hit a couple of home runs. He ended up hitting 5 home runs overall. Hasn't really hit so far this season, but, you know, it's only 15 at bat, so it's sort of hard to tell. But, you know, I like his bat overall. He seems to field reasonably well, I think better than I would have expected. But, you know, I think in general, he's a guy who's not going to get a lot of starts unless somebody starts. So, I think bottom line is if Harrison starts a lot of games, something else has gone horribly wrong for the Mets.
So speaking of horribly wrong so far, and we can make this one brief here, but obviously Mike Pelfrey's 15.63 ERA is not going to stand. Is there a deal with him right now? Is he hiding something that we don't know? Is there some sort of small nagging injury that was brushed off as being inconsequential and is... well, we know from Ubaldo Jimenez that a small cut on his thumb seemed relatively inconsequential until he was, you know, barely topping mid-90s on opening day. Anything we need to know about Pelf?
I mean, there's nothing that I've heard. You know, he seems not to have a lot of confidence this year. You know, and outside of his April last year, which was amazing, he had a couple of rough months, and for whatever reason came out of the gate really slow this year. His sinker isn't sinking. His sinker is his... his trademark pitch. You could throw it in the mid-90s, and when it's working well, he's getting tons of ground balls. And, you know, this year, that's not really happening. He doesn't have control. He's walking a lot of guys. And, you know, how much of that do you chalk up to confidence? How much do you chalk up to a couple of bad starts? Is there more pressure on him because he started opening day? And so I don't know if anybody considers him the ace, but he's kind of their number one starter sequentially in the rotation. And, you know, I don't know if that puts any added pressure on him, but there's nothing I know that he's hiding. You know, he's better than this. He's not a fantastic pitcher, but he's certainly better than a 15 ERA. So, not so much for you guys, but I hope he figures it out in the next few days and actually has a good start this week. But, you know, it's disconcerting because Johan Santana obviously isn't around. And so, you know, we were counting on Pelfrey to be, if not a number one pitcher, certainly a good pitcher, something like he was last year. And he hasn't been to this point. And it's certainly a concern. He's never really struck a lot of guys out. You can look at his number, his strikeout rates have never really been good, but, you know, he's generally contained the walks and he's relied on getting a lot of ground balls. And, you know, and that's just not happening right now.
All right. Well, is there anything else you want to mention before we let you go?
Yeah, before we go, let's just get a quick series preview. 4-game series. How do you think it fares?
I guess a split. But in saying that, I wouldn't be surprised if either team swept. Obviously, you seem to remember the Rockies playing especially poorly when they come to New York. So, from my perspective, I hope that continues, but I would guess probably 2-2 is pretty reasonable from both sides.
Man, considering our past in New York, a split would be delightful.
Be happy to take it.
And also considering our road play in general, when we have been out in some of the places out east, it's been pretty rough the past couple of years. So, go ahead.
I sort of wonder why that is. You know, a friend of mine has kind of this pet theory about how playing for the Rockies, there's a sort of this Coors carryover effect that when you leave Colorado, you sort of have this, you know, sort of a raised level of confidence in your bat. But, I mean, at least coming eastward, it sounds like that's not the case. I don't know if that's something that has actually been studied or whether that's something you guys have.
There was an article up about the effects of pitching the fastball. Do you remember which blog that was, Andrew?
Well, yeah.
That up?
one of the users on Athletics Nation actually pointed out that one of the big problems in Coors Field for pitching, besides thin air and, yeah, the ball carries more, you know, whatever, big power alleys, is just as far as throwing your pitches go, everyone said, oh, your curveball doesn't break right. Oh, your slider doesn't bite as much. It's not actually that so much. You can usually still get roughly the desired effect out of your breaking stuff. It's when you're throwing your fastball that you're expecting to get, you know, 7 inches of movement. It suddenly is only getting 4 inches of movement, and it doesn't seem like much, but baseball's been known as a game of inches, and guys like Carlos Gonzalez will feast on a straightening out fastball, so that's one of the horror stories there. But you mentioned kind of a hangover effect there. Tom Tango, in his book, The Book, when he was doing a lot of his hitter calculations to try to determine, you know, hot streaks and cold streaks and what's the relevance there statistically and what have you, he actually made a mention that he disregarded Coors Field hitters or people coming out of a series in Coors Field because of how different the hitting and pitching environment is, that there usually is a hangover coming out of Coors Field, that he said it's one team, it's not really effective to that particular study. And so, I mean, he made mention of it and proceeded to, you know, just ignore numbers coming right out of Coors Field. So, you know, there's that to think about too.
And of course, in this series, we're coming out from Pittsburgh. So, we haven't been home in a while, and it probably won't be too much of a Coors related effect. Maybe they have already adjusted to some degree. Although we had a pretty ugly offensive game, was it yesterday? That all that crazy stuff happened, or was it on Friday?
When all you mean the extra innings game?
Yeah,
that was Friday. All that crazy stuff. Yeah, man.
I've repressed it all.
Snakes coming out of the bullpen, and oh, it was crazy.
No, it was a crazy game.
Friday was the all the insanity and with the extra innings and the refusal to hit baseballs and win games.
It was by far our worst offensive performance so far this season on Friday.
7 games.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's all I got. Is there anything particularly you wanted to mention, Eric?
I mean, I think we've pretty much covered it. I you know, the only thing we haven't really talked about, I guess, is the change in front office personnel that the Mets had this offseason. You know, they've been held by Omar Minaya for a long time, and, you know, he's been much maligned by us as well as plenty of other people, but, you know, he has a scouting background, and so he sort of had a reputation for, I say general managing from the gut as opposed to the brain. And, you know, now we've got Sandy Alderson, who came in from San Diego, and he's of course famous for being general manager of the A's when they won the World Series. And, you know, he was an early focal point in the book Moneyball and sort of the early chapters there. And he brought over Paul DePodesta, also from San Diego, and J.P. Ricciardi, who was with the Red Sox at the time. And so, you know, it's kind of refreshing as a fan of the team as a statistically inclined fan of the team to see them move in this direction and to kind of understand the thought process behind some of the transactions. Whereas, you know, maybe last year with Omar Minaya, he signed Alex Cora to a guaranteed deal with a vesting option for $2 million. And you get the sense that that's not the sort of thing that Sandy Alderson would do.
Or the kind of contract you should be giving to Alex Cora.
Well, that anybody should do, but it's, you know, but I don't think that's the exclusive territory of Omar Minaya. There are plenty of GMs who would do something similar. I mean, Alex Cora is still playing. In fact, the Mets just played him today. He started at third base for the Nationals.
Anyways, thanks very much for being on the show today, Eric.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back sometime, and thanks again.
Anytime. Thanks, guys.
All right, that was Eric Simon. I keep almost saying Eric Steven, who was our last guest from the previous week. All the baseball writers have similar names. We have two Andrews, and yeah.
Yeah, there's two Eric managers out there. It gets confusing for me, too.
So we are just going to wrap this up real quick to preview the next week's worth of games. We are headed to New York, and we start tonight on Monday the 11th, 5 o'clock, Mountain Time. It'll be Hamill versus Pelfrey. And then on the 12th, It is, I already closed the window, so I'm going off memory here. It will be, Rogers versus Nice, and then on the next day it should be De La Rosa versus R.A. Dickey, the knuckleballer we were just talking about, and then the last game of the series should be Greg Reynolds versus Chris Capuano. And then we come back home after these eight games on the road. We'll face the Cubs. I don't really know who's pitching for them yet, but Chacin will be on Friday. So that is pretty much everything we need to cover there. Is there anything else you want to bring up?
Really, I think we had a good enough conversation with Eric that I don't, and I spent enough time ranting and rambling that I don't think anyone wants to hear us talk anymore.
Well, they can always turn it off. If you're still listening to us,
we need to like make medals or something. Or commit you, yeah, what's wrong with you?
For our one-hour podcast, when there's all these podcasts out there that are like 3.5 hours long.
Oh, yeah, I don't understand how you can listen to 3.5 hours of anything.
I actually listen to a lot of them while I'm just out walking or jogging or something like that.
Oh, that works. At work, I have to focus so much that if anything has like words in it, I'm like, wait, hang on, I have to divide my attention. Anyways, blah, 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 I want to go do things now.
Yeah, we will be back next Monday on the 18th, and we'll see you then. Take care.